This is the Business Report with Gary Strubel on Nova 103.5.
Welcome to it. You're on your way home, and you've got a long weekend ahead of you, so well done for hanging in there. Just tonight's show to get through and all the cool stuff you can think about during the long weekend. What's coming up? Well, we'll talk to James Niopi, the Hydrogen Commissioner and Presidential Advisor around these factors. He's got a fascinating part one of an interview we did with him this week around the whole development of green hydrogen in Namibia. Marco Raffinetti, the CEO of Hyphen Energy, also speaks to us. This is, of course, on the back of Green Hydrogen Conference that took place here in Windhoek last week. Stuart Lohman talks to us about all stuff biz news, some interesting stories coming out there. And in our Market Watch, Fadila Bierkus, who's a recruitment officer at APS, on the potential for Namibia to develop as an international call center environment and what the challenges for that would be. Interesting, the 4IR report was also handed over to the president this week, and the chair of that task force, Professor Anisha Peters, speaks to us about the enormous job that they've done over the last year or so in compiling a country readiness report. Are we ready for the fourth industrial revolution? And some of her answers are quite surprising. All of that and more coming up in tonight's show. Stick around. But first, it's time for the business flash briefing.
Rebuilding the economy starts now. RMB Namibia Corporate and Investment Banking, proud partner of BizNews.
With your BizNews, I'm Charlize Maslengle. The Namibia Investment Promotion and Development Board has deployed 5 investment and export promotion attachés to strategically select markets as it seeks to attract more investment into the country. The Heartleaf Group, a subsidiary of the ONL Group, and the Namibia Food and Allied Workers Union has signed a 1-year substantive agreement taking effect on 1st July 2022. The agreement sees the bargaining unit employees receiving a 7% increase on their basic salaries and adjusted transport allowance, as well as a realignment of package benefits to eliminate discrepancies. A U.S. bankruptcy judge on Wednesday declined to appoint an equity committee in Revlon Inc.'s bankruptcy, rejecting a minority shareholder demand for a greater say in the cosmetics company's restructuring. And Japan's prime minister on Wednesday called for a push to revive the country's nuclear power industry in a bid to tackle soaring imported energy costs linked to the war in Ukraine. I'm Charlize Maslengle. Stay tuned for more updates.
A sudden storm shouldn't disrupt your long-term outlook. Access RMB's flexible short-term liquidity. Rebuilding our economy starts now. RMB Namibia, a division of First National Bank of Namibia Limited.
Gary Strubel on the Business Report.
So the South African consumer price inflation has remained on the upper limit of the Reserve Bank's target range for the third consecutive month. According to the latest figures by Stats SA, inflation in July reached 7.8%. That's up from 7.4% in June 2022. In July last year, inflation was sitting at 4.6%. Here is South African economist Chris Hart with his comment.
Inflation accelerated to a 13-year high of 7.8% in July 2022. It is actually scheduled to be even going higher as we go forward. And the foundation of this inflation was set already last year with the incredible rise of government expenditure that was really unfunded as a result of COVID. That has been really undermining the value of the currency. And at the same time, we've seen fuel prices rise. The war in Ukraine has exacerbated the situation. But I think the war in Ukraine, to a large extent, is a lovely political deflection as to what is actually happening. I think the carbon taxes and the attack on fossil fuels, as it were, also fueling inflation in petrol and diesel. There's a long way to go. The central banks are way behind the curve. It's not just in South Africa, but we're seeing this phenomenon around the world. Inflation is rising as a result of government spending largesse. And this is something that's going to take a long time to cure. So at the same time, while we're seeing slowing economies, we're seeing central banks having to raise interest rates. And again, they're raising interest rates in South Africa against very, very poor demand. Means inflation itself is not really going to be curtailed by the hike in interest rates, but interest rates have to be hiked in any case because they're not at the right level relatively to inflation. We've got a repo rate of 5.5% against an inflation rate of 7.8%, and 5.5% is just not the right level for our repo rate if we want to actually have any hope that interest rates are going to curtail inflation. However, because inflation is rising and we've had a very long extended period of very low interest rates, we've had a lot of malinvestment in the global economy. We're seeing this in China, where investment in property, for instance, is starting to unravel. The malallocation of capital has been going on for a very long time, so it's unlikely that the global economy will actually withstand sustained interest rate hikes in the foreseeable future without some major crisis emerging, as these high interest rates are going to expose the malallocation of capital that has been taking place over the past 10 years. So basically, the problems that we saw in the global financial crisis of 2008 were never resolved. It was a case of debt was the problem, and so more debt was thrown at the problem, and so it was really just kicking the can down the road. We're going to see this starting to come home to roost. We're going to see countries go bankrupt. In other words, the inability of countries to actually curb these financial crises, it's going to be an interesting period ahead. In the meantime, hard assets like gold, for instance, is probably going to do well from an investment point of view, you know, in the fullness of time. In the short term, you can see fluctuations and even this coming down, but over the longer term, this is something that's going to actually be the type of asset, hard assets and things like property as well, doing fairly well because we're seeing problems with the global supply chains. Investment in farmland is also starting to do well. Investment in agriculture and food security is also going to start really taking off over the next few years. So there are opportunities that come out of this, but in the meantime, at the top level, there's going to be a very, very rocky road going forward.
That's South African economist Chris Hart talking about South Africa's inflation, of course. Their inflation often becomes ours as well. Time now for the lead story, and David Bishop brings us this report and interview with James Neopi.
The Business Report. Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Novo 103.5.
The lead story is proudly brought to you by Alex Forbes. Alex Forbes, let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future. I'm speaking today to Presidential Advisor James Neupe, though today he's wearing his Hydrogen Commissioner hat. Hello, Mr. Neupe.
Hey, David. How's it going?
Good, thanks. And you?
Awesome. Nice to meet you.
So there's obviously a lot of excitement about green hydrogen. I think, though, what a lot of people want to know is when. You know, what progress has been made on the project thus far? When's it expected that Namibia will start seeing benefits from it?
Now, fantastic. And, you know, I'd love to keep on sort of encouraging the viewers to start looking beyond the project and to start looking at the industry, right? So last week, for example, the world descended upon Namibia. We had somebody here from every continent off the planet. I think there were like three or four private jets that were hanging out at Hosea Kotaku International Airport. And not all of them were here for Hyphen, right? They were here to do business with you, right? In your country, using some of your land, using some of your port or rail infrastructure. So what is the bigger industry and what's going on? So last week, for example, we, you know, unlocked a $500 million injection into the Namibian economy, nothing at all to do with the Hyphen project. Everything to do with pilot projects of Namibian businesses that were looking to participate in the industry and not necessarily in Hyphen. So I think that train has left the station. Literally, for some people, they're going to start building train stations. I think local businesses are receiving capital as we speak to build projects today. And I think that's the bigger deal. The Hyphen project itself, next key milestone is implementation agreement. We want to get that signed in November. So government is now putting the last final touches of its negotiation with Hyphen. And they were negotiating on all sorts of things, whether it's equity stakes or, for example, when do they actually get to start with their feasibility? All those sort of things is what we're putting our final touches on. And COP27, November, Egypt, is the stage that we're aiming to get to. It's a pretty tight squeeze. We hope we make it, but that's what we're aiming for. So that's the next big milestone. And then after that, you know, they start their feasibility, which is 110 to 140 million US dollars. So you're looking at 2 billion Namibian dollars, easy peasy. I mean, again, that should start quarter one next year. And that's real money, right? Like feasibility studies, there'll be guys in Namibia that will help them erect wind masts, start small scale construction, do environmental impact assessments. So again, you don't have to wait for the main construction, which is slated for 2025. You could start getting involved today. They're already starting to hire, etc.
And you obviously, I mean, you're rubbing shoulders with a lot of people around the world now. Part of the sort of knock-on on this perhaps is just that Namibia is now being spoken about. We're kind of everywhere at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, absolutely. And, you know, that was kind of a big part of the aim, right? So if you looked at HPP2, the way we articulated the green hydrogen or green ammonia gig was we thought it was a strategic bet. And the reason we said strategic bet was because of that as well. We thought the payoff was asymmetric in nature. Small investment, you know, a few sort of trips around the world, start showcasing an RFP, but the payoff could be massive. And you're absolutely right. If you looked at last week, I was shocked for the first time, you know, because I've been around the world, you're right, people are quite interested. But last week, there were people here from Bosch wanting to build a whole solar plant from scratch, like mining the silica to turn, you know, like to actually building the panels. And like a multi-billion dollar investment, and not just in Namibia. The solar was in Namibia. They wanted to do electrolyzers in South Africa. They wanted to do some assembly in Bots. And they were not small fry, right? And that was one of at least seven proposals I saw that were hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in nature. Now, of course, not all of those will convert. But to your point, Namibia is on the lips of a lot of people around the planet. And that's fantastic, you know, because some of them, I met a guy last week who is the head of DHL. Oh, he used to be the head of DHL. Now he runs their foundation. And he came because through his foundation, they've been supporting some of our research. So again, FDI. But he came with his wife because after the conference, he went for a week hopping around on a plane because he's a pretty wealthy guy, you know, spraying some cash into our economy. Fantastic, right? Helps tourism, helps jobs, helps FDI, but also just helps the global recognition. So super exciting, I think, and there's just more to come, right?
You talk about the sort of not just bringing in panels and sort of capturing the entire value chain. How important is that in our negotiations and in our talks that we don't just have people coming in and putting stuff down on the ground?
Super critical, super, super, super critical, because what we're envisioning, again, is beyond a project. We're envisioning a synthetic fuels industry that has the capability of potentially to absorb 5 to 7, possibly 10 hyphens. You know, 10 sounds like a lot. So I always sort of scale that number down because the technical studies are saying we could do 10. And I'm just like, that's too much for my brain to try and compute. So I'm saying maybe 5 or 7. 5 or 7 hyphens is redonkulous, right?
Lot, yeah.
It is like 1.5 million tons of green hydrogen. It is, you know, if hyphen is going to be a $12 billion project, you know, you're looking at $60 billion. So those numbers are ridiculous. Now, if you're going to do those sort of size projects, you can justify an electrolyzer manufacturing plant in Namibia. You can justify wind blade assembly here. You can justify potentially, you know, manufacturing solar plants. Now, one of the things a lot of the people are also recognizing is that Namibia is 2.5 million people. Yes, we now have this land that can allow for outsized investments into our country beyond just our people. So guys are not investing in us because we have 27 million or 100 million people. They're investing in us because we can serve 100 or a billion people by producing products here that the world wants. The other thing that's happening, David, is folks are realizing they can serve other African markets from Namibia. So the solar plant, or even there's a conversation about a guy who wants to build an electrolyzer plant here. They would want to be exporting some of those electrolyzers into the Buchu Bay project in Northern Cape, you know, into Botswana eventually when they do large-scale solar. And that begins to become a really, really interesting play for Namibia, especially with this whole ambition of becoming a logistics hub as well, right? Because then you can transport the stuff into the other African nations, but you form the special economic zone manufacturing thing in Walvis Bay because we have tons of space. We have the port right there. So that's where we're going with all of this, yeah.
Okay. No offense to you, but, you know, there are people who will say, well, you know, you come from government, you're going to say these things. But we were talking earlier about studies.
Yeah.
Are there studies that people can actually go, you know, if they don't want to believe James Newpair, they can go and read for themselves?
100. I mean, we're on radio, but I'm holding my iPad. and there's a study that, you know, research, there's tons of research out there. But the one I would read if I just wanted to understand the market, especially the ammonia market, because that's actually the first product we're making.
Uh-huh.
Green hydrogen in itself will be pretty hard to trade viably today, right? Whereas ammonia, that is being traded today.
Mm.
And when you make green ammonia, it should be displacing gray ammonia. Then the issue is price, and we can talk about that as well. But there's a really cool, easy, user-friendly piece of research to read from Irina. It's called Innovation Outlook, and it's focusing on renewable ammonia, right? And it will go and sort of show you how the ammonia market is expected to evolve between now and 2050. And what is amazing, you know, we're going from about 200 million tons of ammonia in terms of demand, and by 2050, we're looking at 700 million, right? So more than a tripling.
What's driving that demand?
Exactly. It's the shipping. The big part of the new demand that comes on is actually shipping.
Okay.
Yeah. And when you look at what Namibia is doing, I mean, we're stitching some of this stuff really opportunistically, but it's really working.
Oh.
We put out a national container terminal sort of RFP last year, and we've received proposals, and they're now being reviewed today. But one of those proposals is to grow the container terminal big time,
mm-hmm.
right? So from 750,000 TEU capacity, potentially to more than 2 million. And the guys vying for that are like some of the largest shipping companies in the world, right? So that was happening anyway. And that's also a multi-billion dollar investment, mm-hmm. by the way. They're going to dredge the thing, make it deeper, and then they want to make it a transshipment hub. Huge play. Now, when I started talking to some of them and I told them about our ammonia ambitions to produce ammonia, they lost it, right? Because some of them want to start converting their ships to run on ammonia, green ammonia, okay. to be specific, right? So there are five sort of hard-to-abate sectors out there, or at least five key ones. Power, steel, just normal hydrogen production, ammonia, and then transport is the other one. And in transport, long-haul trucking, shipping, and aviation are huge. And with shipping, some of these guys are buying the ships quarter three 2023, as in next year. And they're saying, hold on, so Namibia could become a key hub for me to actually refuel on my global trips. And CMB and ONL are doing and envisioning exactly that. So remember, those two want to build a 2.5 billion euros, so 40 billion plus, liquid bulk ammonia terminal in Walvis Bay. Mm. And CMB runs like a whole bunch of ships, I think more than 300 ships around the world. And, you know, like shipping buddies talk to one another. So all of a sudden, like, that's a huge play for
us.
A big transshipment hub with ammonia bulk. And then one of the things we now want to start sorting out is the rail. Because once you start sorting out the rail and you're decarbonizing that, you have one of the most unique footprints across the continent, possibly even you're rivaling with the world, to become that transshipment hub. And that's that whole sector coupling that we're trying to do sort of at a government level. But, you know, like you said, you don't have to believe us. Read this particular piece of writing. I think you guys will link it in the interview.
Yep, we'll link.
And then go from there.
Speaking about those smaller projects, and you mentioned the rail, so, you know, you've got the project with Transnamib that was announced last week. We see that they're currently looking to sell off properties to fund their turnaround plan. How is Transnamib involved in the greater scheme of things, and how will the project benefit them?
Yeah. You know, and I mean, the project is probably a drop in the bucket of a larger plan to try and infuse capital, but also assistance, private sector involvement, to turn around Transnamib. And, you know, sometimes we think of Transnamib, the company, then people get personal and they start thinking of the board and the CEO. But if you just think of Transnamib and the rail sector and the role it has to play in the ambition that we have with the synthetic fuels industry, it is massive, right? You're going to be moving wind blades that are like 180 meters long. You can't move all of that stuff on road. You might need to ship some of that on rail. You're going to be bringing three times the number of containers through Walvis Bay. Some of those are going up north, maybe possibly to Congo. Some of that is on rail. You're going to be moving potentially at some point in time synthetic fuels, right? So methane, stuff like that. We want to move some of that from Ochodonjupa region to Irongo region. That is on rail. And so with those possibilities, one of the things that we do see is the ability for private sector to come and work with Transnamib. PPPs, joint ventures, whatever, right? And that will bring in technical expertise, capital, And so, yes, we're definitely wobbling right now, like with Transnamib, the strike, stuff like that. But, you know, this project, however many million euros it is, just gives them a bit of a shot in the arm, begins to help them see the future. And then what I actually would love to do is get them cheap concessionary climate-related capital to potentially start buying them new wagons. Because at the moment, the idea was to get, I think it was $2 billion or something like that, Namibian dollars, from DBSA. But, you know, that's a fairly typical loan. But if I can get like super, super cheap loan to buy wagons, but that are going to run on dual fuel or even electricity or hydrogen, you know, that's super interesting. And then there are lots of customers overseas that would love to then be shipping or railing their product on a train with a low carbon footprint, because that goes to the second or third order effect that they have to report to their shareholders. So that's the bigger thinking. But, you know, like Transnamib, I feel them, but they're super excited, at least the technological guys we're working with. A lot of work has to be done to sort of fix the governance, and that's above my pay grade, right?
For more on this interview and Namibia's green hydrogen project, tune in to next week's show, where we'll talk jobs, skills, and some of the interesting things James has learned along the way. The lead story was proudly brought to you by Alex Forbes. Alex Forbes, let us help you secure your financial well-being now and in the future.
The Business Report. Podcasts on nova.com.na. Namibia's business leader on Nova 1035.
Continuing with something of a green hydrogen focus on this week's show, I'm speaking to the CEO of Hyphen Energy, Marco Raffinetti. Hello, Mr. Raffinetti.
Morning, David. Good to be with you this morning.
Now, your company's come a long way with the Namibian government already, but how optimistic are you that the project will be signed off by the Namibian government by the end of the year?
We're very optimistic, David. We've undertaken an enormous amount of work together with the government. It obviously is something very, very complicated, because we're not just trying to sign an agreement to enable Hyphen to develop its project. We're looking to work with the government to help finalize the establishment of an industry, of a hydrogen industry in Namibia, that will provide for not only the first project, but subsequent projects after that. So there's a lot of very meaty and complicated work that needs to be done and decisions that need to be made. But we're moving very rapidly, and certainly both government and Hyphen are committed to the timeline, and we're highly confident that that timeline is going to be achieved.
Speaking of the timeline, what does that look like from the signing? We're hearing the date 2025, 2026 a lot, but what steps get us there, and where do we go as a country from there?
Perfect question, David. Effectively, where we are now, we preferred bidder, and we're working towards becoming the awarded bidder. So by the end of this year, the suite of legal agreements are proposed to be signed that will effectively outline how we will develop the project so that we can take what's called a financial investment decision, which is by the end of 2024, to enable us to then implement the project, commencing from a construction perspective in early 2025. So the idea is, the first stage is to agree what Hyphen is going to do, what government is going to do, what legislation needs to be put in place, how the land will be made available, how the tax regime for this industry will work, etc. That's what we're focusing on now, get that architecture right. Then we will then commence with all the final detailed engineering works and studies from the end of this year till the end of 2024, with the intention to then take that final investment decision and start building in early 2025. Two-odd year build period for the first phase of the project. So go live with first product supplied into regional and international markets beginning of 2026.
Okay. Speaking to the country's green hydrogen ambassador, James Nupe, he emphasized that we shouldn't just be looking at the end point, especially in terms of employment. What kind of jobs have already been created, and what skills is Hyphen most looking for in both the short and the long term?
James is very correct. We're going to need lots of people, both during the development phase and as we move to construction. So where we are now, very pleased to say we've taken a lease on our offices in Namibia and are starting to fit those out. We've taken the top floor of the new courtside development that Nedbank put up next to Nedbank's head office. We now have five full-time employees, all Namibians that we've recruited. And we'll be looking to then ramp up our internal team in Namibia so that it's not just employees from the shareholder group. That team will then grow from now until when we commence construction. I think where the huge growth in numbers will arise is when we do start the construction process, where we estimate we're going to need around 15,000 people. There'll be a lot of general laborers, but also very, very highly technical skilled. So it's going to be from let's say your less skilled workers all the way to your very, very skilled workers. And we have recruited someone to specifically look at this topic for us and find out where we're going to recruit these people by undertaking baseline assessments, working with the University of Namibia, identifying the skill sets that we need, looking to ensure that the training programs in the universities are being put in place to train people. And then from a Hyphen perspective, one of our shareholders is looking to take a first set of trainees into their facilities in Germany as wind turbine technicians. And we're hoping to do that at the end of this year as we look to start training our people. This will be a process. It's not an event. It's a process to identify the skills that we'll need both during the construction period and during the operations period. And effectively, we're looking to put in place processes to build up and train people so that when we enter into each of those two distinct phases, the people that we need and the local people that we need in order to support the project have been trained up, skilled up, and are ready to be deployed on the project.
Jobs, of course, are only one way in which companies operating in the country can contribute towards upskilling and upliftment and empowerment. Does Hyphen have any existing or planned corporate social responsibility activities in place, especially for the communities in which you'll mostly be operating?
Yeah, David, we are looking at defining that at the moment. So there's a massive need in Lüderitz. So if you think of it's a little town, it's got 15,000 odd people. We need to house 15,000 people during construction of the project and then around 3,000 people during operations of the project. So small enterprise development is a key part of what we've committed to focus on with government. How do we build those local businesses or assist to build those local businesses that need to support the project? We don't, for example, necessarily want to build housing for people. That's an opportunity for local businesses to do that. We don't want to do catering or transporting of workers. We'd like to outsource that. So these are the topics that we're going to look over the next 2 years together with government and our social economic development leads to identify where we can find those local companies to provide those services into the project. And that we believe will be a big stimulator of economic growth and particularly in the Lüderitz region, which has suffered a number of years of declining economic performance.
Obviously we understand Hyphen's a business venture. So, I mean, profit motive is key, but are there any specific sort of decarbonization goals that the company aims to achieve or a desire perhaps to make an impact on the global carbon footprint?
Absolutely. I think, David, our sole reason for existence is to help drive decarbonization globally. And we think that Namibia is uniquely placed to play an oversized role in that decarbonization journey. So what we're focusing on is exporting around 350,000 tons of hydrogen. We convert it into ammonia to export it. So we combine the hydrogen with nitrogen in order to make ammonia. And once you've combined it, that's around 2 million tons of ammonia. If you look at currently what's happening in Europe, natural gas is used to make ammonia, which is then used to make fertilizer. That natural gas is under huge pressure in terms of supply because a large amount of that is coming from Russia. So there's a supply risk in Europe that obviously then affects the food chain and everybody then feels that increased cost in their pockets when they have to pay more for food staples that require fertilizer to be grown. But more importantly, or maybe not more importantly, equally as importantly is the manufacture of ammonia at the moment with natural gas primarily emits a huge amount of carbon. So our project will offset somewhere around 5 to 6 million tons of carbon emissions a year once we are at full production scale, which is an enormous contribution. And we think that's just the tip of the iceberg for Namibia. We think Namibia could host or has enough land and resources to have 50 five-zero-sized Hyphen projects developed by other developers. So that's an enormous amount of carbon reduction that Namibia can help the world on this decarbonization journey.
Well, finally, while we're talking about those lofty and yeah, amazingly sounding ambitions, do you, and if so, how do you foresee Hyphen and the green hydrogen project you're involved with the government impacting and changing Namibia?
We think this industry is going to have a fundamental impact on Namibia, David. Namibia is very unique in that it's a small country in terms of its population, but it's a massive country in terms of its land. So you've got large amounts of uninhabited land that are suitable for development for green hydrogen. Not many countries in the world have that abundance of land, but you also have that abundance of land as well as with the resource. So if you look at the foreign direct investment for our project, it's somewhere in the order of $10 billion, which is roughly equivalent to Namibia's GDP. The project will generate, well, obviously we'll employ people that'll generate salaries for local staff and a large number of them. We'll pay taxes to the government on the products that we sell. We'll also pay royalties to government. On each ton of product we sell, there'll be a royalty on that paid to government. And then all the land that the project is going to be developed on is owned by the state, so we'll pay land rentals to the government. That's all value going directly to the government that then can be used for social programs, etc. And if you think that you can have 50 of these projects in Namibia, the amount of economic development that can be stimulated in Namibia is enormous. Mm. And we think, again, that's looking very narrowly focused just on establishing solar and wind and green hydrogen production for exports. But really, with an abundance of cheap renewable energy, that can be used to drive industrialization in Namibia. So, you know, we will have to import a lot of the equipment that we need for the first project. But as you get to the third, fourth, fifth, tenth project, a lot of that equipment can be manufactured internally in Namibia. We think that's a huge opportunity for local businesses to participate in the overall value chain and use the renewable energy that will be generated by the project to drive Namibia's economy.
That sounds fantastic. Thank you very much, Mr. Refinetti.
Absolute pleasure. Great speaking to you. I'm looking forward to updating your listeners as the project progresses over the coming years.
Thank you very much.
The Business Report. Namibia's business leader on Nova 1035.
The Biz News Ramp is driven by the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology and comfort. Book your test drive today at M&Z Motors. M&Z Motors is proud to introduce the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology, and comfort. Contact M&Z Jeep and Fiat Group today for your test drive. Or visit the M&Z Jeep and Fiat Group Facebook page and check out their great offers. Jeep, go anywhere, do anything. Right, let's connect up with our partners down there in South Africa, biznews.com, to just get a bit more clarity on some of the big stories on the site. Lots of interesting things going on over the last week, as there almost always is in South Africa. Stuart Lohman, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Gary. Always good to be here.
Let's start out with a story that broke on your site earlier this week and has grown legs. And this is Ranmore Fund's founder, Sean Pesch, who wrote an article or broke a story around, blew the whistle perhaps on exorbitant performance fees that sit at the moment in fund management. Give us a little bit of background to this.
Yeah, so Alec chatted to Sean. He's actually coming out this week for our conference next week, Gary, so it should be good to tap his ear. But Alec had an interview with him on, I wouldn't say it's not so much whistleblowing as more just highlighting certain things in fund fact sheets that maybe potential retail investors don't necessarily scan through enough. Looking at performance fees and fees around investing in these funds. So he's just had a look, and he's obviously compared how things work in South Africa with the UK, and performance fees are at the top of the discussion because there's no such thing in the UK, really, in his industry. They don't do performance fees. You just get a fee based on the investment. So just highlighting the exorbitant cost structure, one could say, around investing in certain funds in the South African market, and that's where the discussion centered on. It's his second sort of discussion on this topic. He spoke to Alec a week or two ago about balance funds and sort of the fee concern there on how much the fund managers are sort of taking out of investor contributions in a sense, you know, because you also lose that compound nature of investing if you're giving so much away in fees. It's one of your biggest bugbears. I mean, Warren Buffett always talks about make sure you watch the fees because it hurts you in the 20, 30, 40 year time scale. So more shining a light, as we say, on things in an industry that have maybe sort of gone unnoticed.
But I mean, these are significant issues, and these are big companies. The ones that particularly are highlighted, Allan Gray, Coronation 91, these funds are worth billions, and a quarter of a percent or a tenth of a percent every month or annually, as the case may be, starts making a difference even in the short term. And the vast majority of people actually don't have a clue what fees they're paying on their investment funds. It might even be on the statement, but they're also not always really sure what they can do about it. What it's highlighted, perhaps, is the importance for people making investments to understand the nature of what they're going into.
For sure. I mean, if you look on Twitter as well, sort of Easy Equities or Purple Groups, you have Charles Savage got involved, and he said, well, you don't pay fees on sort of investing by yourself, in a sense, on a lot of the products they sort of offer. So I think it's a big discussion, Gary, and I think, as you say, it goes unnoticed in a sense. You know, you've been told from a young age, put your 500-600 rand or 1,000 rand, 2,500 that your company suggests you do into a fund, and you never really dug into the nature of the fund, and now you're stuck with the fund because you can't take it out before you're 65, in a sense, you know. So it's almost like not entrapment. I don't think that's the right word, but there's not much a lot of people can do about it now. You can stop contributing to the fund, of course, but then you probably get a little penalty on that as well. So there's all these caveats, you know, to the issue that's highlighted, but maybe fixing it's not as easy from an investor point of view as we think.
I was just going through the story, and then just for anyone who's interested and wants to go and read it, the thing that really stood out for me is it initially said it was in the region of about a 320 billion rand kind of deficit between, you know, perhaps what should be being charged and what is being charged. And those are, of course, outstanding numbers. And then in the follow-up, he said actually it's closer to 600 billion that is being recovered by fund managers, specifically with regards to performance fees. I mean, those are unbelievable numbers.
I mean, he also highlighted the benchmarks that these performances are judged against. And it's almost like he says the benchmarks are created by the very fund managers that set them. So you choose the benchmark you want to work against, and you can base your performance fee around that benchmark. So it's very, not incestuous, but it's very, you know, self-fulfilling prophecy type thing where you create your mark that you set, you know, and you earn on it and as a fund manager. So it's, I don't know, it's like we said, it's nothing new though, Gary. It's just, it's been brought to the fore, you know. It's probably something, as Magnus Hastick said, it's something that's been bubbling under, and maybe this will bring it to the surface so that something can be done about it. You know, Alec also mentioned in the interview these, that they're like marketing behemoths, you know. If you know, every airport you walk into, who's on the board? You know, we can all say it's either a Coronation or an Allan Gray encouraging you to invest, but a lot is hidden behind that. But yeah, it's a big discussion. Hopefully something comes of it, and let's see.
Okay, let's move on. Sasol has had a fairly tempestuous last decade, hampered and aided by global events. Story on the site about that. Give us some background.
Yeah, so Sasol results, as an investor, some good times back. They reinstated a dividend, which shows that times have sort of turned around. If you rewind 2 years back, I think it is scary, from a market point of view, the share price was at 20 Rand. 2 years later, it's at 400, it hit 450, 460. And that sort of highlights the turnaround. Sasol's been a darling. It's always a darling amongst SA investors, you know, but obviously hit rock bottom 2 years ago. CEO Fleetwood Crobler just interviewed again by Alec, highlighting what's happened. I mean, we can also look at the oil price as a big barometer for that company, which is, what, at $100 at the moment. So, yeah, good turnaround for South Africa. I see in the results as well a lot of discussion around green energy, et cetera, et cetera. So a good story, especially from an investor point of view, if you took the risk 2 years ago, and it has turned around and it is a South African investor darling type stock, you know, very well watched in the business community especially.
I suppose, I mean, it's worth just highlighting that number. That's a 20 times return in the space of 24 months on a stock that was never going to go bust. Too big to fail, I think, is a term that's often used just even in terms of a Southern African thing. I suppose the real question would be, and I don't know if you ever thought about it, is have we missed it? Is it has it hit its peak? Does Sasol still have legs? Is there somewhere for it to go?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I don't think I could throw my hat into that ring. But there's two interesting stories, Sasol and Thungela, both. One was a Anglo sort of offshoot. You know, it was divested out of Anglo as a coal producer. And then you've got Sasol as sort of oil generally, or seen as oil, petrol, etc. So both shares, 10 baggers, 20 baggers, as you've mentioned, both in fossil fuels, things that we've been told not to invest in. You know, the future's all green, green, green. It just goes to show, I always say, go against the trend. In a sense, sometimes it works. You're in a slack set. Thungela's gone from 30 Rand to 300 in 2 years. Sasol from 20 Rand to 450. So I think I don't know if you've missed it. I wouldn't put my money to say yes or no. I think that's, you know, we keep financial advice out of these discussions. But yeah, you've definitely missed something and who knows where it goes. But you'll be told not to invest in them if you follow the eco warriors on Twitter, etc.
Yeah. Okay. And then just in closing, an interesting story, Sandra Lawrence is contributing some really interesting material to the business community. Cyril is approaching the courts. This is, of course, President Ramaphosa, has chosen to oppose an application by the Democratic Alliance to have Cadre deployment declared unlawful. So what the DA have done politically is put him in a corner and then threaten him with a cattle prodder. If he lets them move forward without opposing it, he's saying they're right. And if he opposes it, he's effectively saying, this is right. He's chosen to go party first, I think, would probably be the interpretation. And how much do we read into what are we seeing with Cadre deployment at the moment? It's been spoken about for a long period of time. Court actions are looming. The government will, you know, has enormous resources to oppose these things. Well, how do we see this playing out?
Yeah, it's tough again, Gary. If you rewind a bit, so it all comes from the Zondo Commission. And this is something that Cyril put a lot of effort and time behind, you know. It was a 4-year program, cost the taxpayers, I think, R1 billion. And one of the findings out of it was Cadre deployment is unlawful and unconstitutional. So this is where it all stems from. And now, obviously, Cyril's come out in defense of Cadre deployment, and it's almost as if it's part of the ANC cloth. You know, look after your own, no matter what. Is it something that not bring them to their knees, but you've seen what's happened with the Ipsos polls, et cetera, and how the ANC support has dwindled. To what point it will, who knows? 2024 is going to be a big election year for the country, or so we are told, you know, from a lot of the political analysts, et cetera. So I think it's hurting the party's perception, as it would, but you can see through certain numbers that the perception has actually become maybe a tiny bit of a reality in its support. Who can take advantage of that? Who knows? Is the dwindling enough for there to be real progress or change? Again, who knows? But I think it's definitely perceived as a massive problem, Gary. I mean, I know it's almost like it's the way of the ANC, which is quite sad because if you open the door to Cadre, you sort of saying state captures, okay, all these things that have come from Cadre deployment. So, yeah, not good.
Stuart, we're going to leave it there. All I want to say to you is lekker werk tomorrow because it's a public holiday here in Namibia. We celebrate Heroes Day. So we'll be off. We'll be hoping you guys are able to keep the lights on for us over the weekend.
Thanks,
Gary. Stuart Lyman there from biznews.com, our publishing partners down there in South Africa. And that's it for this week's Biz News Weekly Wrap.
The BizNews Ramp is driven by the new Jeep Grand Cherokee 3.6L Limited. Experience the sophisticated side of adventure with premium features including interior, technology and comfort. Book your test drive today at MNZ Motors.
Gary Strubel on the Business Report.
Now, in the Market Watch, we consider a future where Namibia has an opportunity to develop a whole new economy, that as a call center hub. Many countries around the world, most notably India, have huge economies based on a relatively literate population and good telephony services that allow them to provide backup service and call center service to anywhere in the world. Namibia, of course, ideally positioned to perhaps do that in an African context. David Bishop speaks to Fadila Birkas from APS about the challenges on building such an economy.
In our Market Watch this evening, we're joined by Fadila Birkas, the recruitment officer at Africa Personnel Services, to explore the possibilities and challenges for Namibia to potentially become an international call center hub. Hello, Ms. Birkas.
Hi.
Now, to start us off, APS already offers this kind of service. You guys do outsource call center work.
Yes, we do.
How does that work exactly?
Okay, so how we do it, we started about in March. We have this client, international client, that's looking for German-speaking individuals. Not only German, but Danish, Dutch, Finnish, Norwegian, Swedish, German and Polish.
Polish.
Yes, so that's what we're looking for. There's a number of other languages that we'll introduce at a later stage. But at this point, we're only looking for these that I just mentioned. So if you speak any of the languages, you would then apply on the APS website, or either you would then call in if you need any other information from me. So if you are successful, we'll definitely contact you. You go through certain stages, assessments and verbal assessments and final interview. And if you're successful, you would start then the training process, which is 4 weeks. Online training and 2 weeks nursery training. Nursery is where someone would shadow you and to see if you can actually take the call and answer the questions being asked by the client on the other hand. We need people that has a really strong personality because, you know, people are going to, it's not going to be, it's just sunshine and roses.
Yeah.
They're
going
to be angry. They're going to be angry because there's baggage, their baggage is lost, there's refunds, there's rebookings. So you need to keep calm and you need to actually listen to what the customer is complaining about. So it's that in a nutshell. So, yeah, we're just looking for Namibians that can speak another language.
So German, I mean, we know, yeah, we've got a lot of German-speaking Namibians, but all of those, the other languages that you mentioned, do we have people here?
Yes, we do. I've had a few applications for that language. It's just how fluent you are in the language because you might have studied for it, but 4 years in a Pacific country, but you came back and you have been out, you don't really speak it for about 6 years. So then you need to touch up again before you apply, rather than apply it and then we decline you. Just read some books, watch some few movies, just touch up your skill of the language and then you apply for a position.
Now, we've all heard stories about India becoming a sort of call center hub for the world and a lot of calls being rerouted through India. Do you think that that's something that Namibia could aspire to? Could we also become a call center hub for foreign companies?
Most definitely. If we look at our internet speed, you know, making fiber available to all areas in Namibia and only just certain areas, then definitely we can because what we are offering is remote work. So you'll be working from home. We don't need a building that you'll be seated in. You can work from home as long as we as Namibia get our internet sorted.
What kind of, speaking about getting internet sorted, what kind of other infrastructure is required? You were saying homework, that's obvious, people just need a basic computer or?
Yeah. The company is offering the equipment, so you'll receive the equipment if you're successful, which you'll be liable for, of course, because it's something you'll sign off on. But yes, you just need a quiet environment, safe environment, and definitely the internet speed.
And in terms of call center growth for the country, what kind of infrastructure would be required there on a national scale?
At this point, we don't really have, you can't say that specific infrastructure that we need because it's quite easy. It's remote work. There's nothing really needed. It's just a good candidate that can speak the language. And for Namibia to look at just getting the coming all everything always comes back to the internet and the network in Namibia, because we have had complaints regarding this. People that can't, that area is not fiber ready. It's not affordable. People can't afford the internet because if you need to, you get this fixed salary, but you also need, okay, fine, the company would then give you an extra allowance for that, but it's not enough. So
yeah.
You'll then need to use your salary to add on.
You don't want to have to pay to work.
Yeah, affordability it's something we need to look into as well.
Okay. One of the other things, I suppose, if we're saying internet, but Namibians can sometimes be quite surly, and anyone who's gone to a restaurant knows that our customer service isn't always on par. Would we need extensive training there as part of your training to do with customer service? You were talking about complaints. There's ways to deal with complaints. There's ways to handle those. Do you think that's something that might hold the country back?
Most definitely. But on the upside, we do offer the training. So you would then have that shadowing process where you will know how to answer the call and be corrected and, you know, be guided as to how you should be answering, rather than saying, using a slang word. You must always be professional, and at all times be professional. That's very important. So, yeah, you will be guided as to how and what to say.
Okay. Obviously, we've spoken about international demand. Do you foresee local companies possibly also outsourcing their call center functions?
It's opening up to the world now. The world has changed a lot after COVID, and people, the idea of work also changed. So people are looking into opportunities that actually working from home would be better for them. You know, spending time with your family is more first priority now than to work. So if you get an opportunity to actually work from home and be at home with your family, not saying that you would be so much involved in your family life, but at least you are at home. That's already another way to look at it, as like where the world is going.
And with our unemployment levels, it's good to know that there are other options out there.
No, most definitely. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
The Business Report. Podcasts on nova.com.na. The Business Report. Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Nova 1035.
Welcome back to The Business Report. You're on Nova 1035. Now, the Fourth Industrial Revolution Task Force officially handed its country readiness report to President Hage Geingob. The eight-member team, which is chaired by 4IR Task Force Chair and University of Namibia Pro Vice Chancellor, Professor Anisha Peters, was established under the Economic Advancement Pillar of the Harambee Prosperity Plan. That's to assist the government in preparing for the Fourth Industrial Revolution. The task force conducted a country assessment to determine the readiness of Namibia for this and make recommendations towards a coordinated and coherent policy and legislative framework. Professor Anisha Peters, who's the chairperson of the task force, is our guest this evening. Welcome back, Prof. We've chatted a few times about this now. Your assignment is handed in.
Yes, homework is done. Waiting for the grade now.
Okay, so let's just talk a little bit about the homework itself. A report of this nature, just give us, what does it look like? How big is it? What's in it?
Okay, 176 pages. Really, on the report, you know, it's what we did was we had a multi sort of method approach to it. So first of all, we have, for the first time ever, we have a score on the World Economic Forum's Future of Production instrument. So the country has a score where we can compare ourselves and is placed as to, you know, whether it is where it is in the world of 4IR. So that's quite significant.
Is this as a result of the report or?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's an assessment that we did, which was a survey instrument, which was an online survey that we had 514 respondents. Of those, 319 were from businesses, so from industry. And then we had, of course, over 660 individuals and 160 companies participating in stakeholder engagements through focus groups and through interviews. Then we also had the conference and expo that had about 400 people, and we took all of those outcomes. Remember, they were also sort of going over some elements of the report and giving their input. And what we had done additionally is we had always tried to consider also whatever we could find via radio, you know, engagements on television, as well as on social media, to sort of just, you know, have an eye on that, to sort of see, you know, how does it fit in? Because in the end, you want to have triangulation,
right?
And it is basically within the country. It needs to be specific to the country, to the context of the country. And this is why we got sort of a bottom-up approach.
Right. So, I mean, what I'm hearing is that there was an enormous amount of data generated from quite a wide range of different sources, and your job is to put them all together and tell government something.
Exactly. Okay. And, you know, looking, of course, at the sort of secondary data sources as well. Yeah. And so that's where we ended up. And within that report, there are a number of great things where Namibia is doing great in. And there are a number of things, of course, where Namibia is not doing so great in. Some of them, I think majority of them we know. So it's almost like confirmation. And then some of the things we might not have known where we are. And in the end, we sort of took all of those and we drew up the recommendations also from different sources to sort of make it very coherent.
Reports of this nature often have sensitive information, politically sensitive, economically sensitive. So I'm assuming you're not at liberty yet to talk about all the contents of the report.
No, you know, not release the full report per se, because that report, remember, is because it is the president who tasked the task force with it. So essentially the report went to the president, but the president wanted to be as inclusive as possible, and he directed immediately the next day that we had to go and present it to Parliament, to Cabinet, which we did. And so, you know, on some of the highlights, certainly we can talk. Yeah.
So give us an idea. What are the big key findings?
Okay. So as I said, you know, it's the first time that Namibia is actually scored out of the 200 countries that were scored by the World Economic Forum. So on the future of production, sort of for drivers of production, we were scored about a 3 out of 10. That is on complexity of our product mix, you know, economic complexity, as well as scale. On scale, surprisingly, we're still doing really, really well in the region, because we have the manufacturing value added is about 11% of the GDP, which is declining since 2015, but still amongst the highest in the region. And then from there onwards, we were placed in the nascent quadrant of nascent countries. All of the African countries are placed in the nascent quadrant. That means least ready for IR, but we are scoring higher than many of the countries. We are, though, scoring lower than Mauritius, South Africa, Botswana, and Morocco.
And we would consider those to be our peer countries. We would want to be at least on par.
Yes. So we want to be at least on par. Like His Excellency says, you know, we want to compare ourselves to the best.
Yeah.
And if we're looking at the best in the region, you're essentially looking at South Africa, Mauritius, and then Botswana is also doing really well. So that's who we're looking at. Okay, so then from there onwards, what were the bigger sort of findings in that report? What was good is innovation systems. We have a whole lot of businesses who reported innovation of products and services, especially enabled by digital technologies over the past 3 years. That was very significantly high. And then we also saw a lot of entrepreneurs who are coming up with, you know, digital innovations. So that gives you a very good idea that we're really doing well on that score. On other scores, we were doing well, for instance, on the demand environment,
right?
The market size, you know, the sophistication of our consumer base, all of those we scored very high on. So we have quite a lot of potential, but we do need to diversify also into the manufacturing and service added basis. Then we also scored well on sort of on the governance pillar, but on rule of law and corruption perceptions, we scored like third highest in the region. However, where we scored not so good was on future orientation of government, because number one, the cybersecurity, the lack of legislation is one of the big things that is a Namibia is considered a high-risk country for cybersecurity. I think that we also knew. The other area where we are not doing well in is education. Again, you know, it's a good side, bad side story. But the bad side of it is essentially that we are not supporting unemployed people to upskill and reskill themselves to find employment. Industry said that their workforce are not adequately prepared, you know, for there's a skills mismatch with what they expect in industry versus what the VTCs as well as the universities are turning out. And so we find that digital technologies, advanced digital skills are severely lacking. It's almost non-existent within the country.
Was this a surprise? Did we think it was better than that?
Well, I did think that it was slightly better than that. So basic digital skills are quite adequate, but the advanced one, like for AI, for IoT, for cybersecurity, I did think we would get a slightly better score on those, but we did not. And those are prerequisites, you know, for your 4IR. The next thing is trade barriers, significantly. You know, e-commerce barriers, very big. Tax incentives, very big. We need to work on that. We need to work on agile legislation to support future digital business models.
Does that talk a little bit about we need to change our protectionist mindset into being a more competitive mindset? So instead of creating higher walls, we just need to create an environment inside that is conducive to being competitive.
Well, we certainly need to create an environment inside that is conducive. But one of the things is also that if you have a scarcity of skills, like we were seeing specifically where the scarcity of skills are, then you have to bring in the skills. But now you have a problem on immigration, and perhaps they don't know which are these skill sets that you're looking at that's scarce. Now you're having a problem there. We're having a problem on e-commerce, because imagine if somebody is sitting in, which is a far place.
Kamanyap.
Somebody sits in Kamanyap, and if that person would be able to transact online, right, advertise their business and trade online and get their money through PayPal. Currently, they can't, right? And so those type of barriers we have to break down, because the 4IR can be an enabler of everyone and leveling the playing field. Because if you, for instance, one of the things is we have the most expensive mobile data, you know, in the region. So if we bring down the cost of mobile data and zero rated for educational institutions, for instance,
right,
and you support the digital infrastructure that we get more coverage. And of course, you know, if you bring down some of your import duties and taxes on equipment, on ICT equipment, and you can give to the consumers, you know, devices at a lower cost, then you're enabling the person, the entrepreneur, the unemployed youth,
yeah,
in Kamanyap to essentially do their business and trade borderlessly.
Okay.
So legislative environment is, of course, another big one. But one of the big things that we are seeing is the lack of coordination. It's not only prevalent, you know, in government, it's also prevalent, you know, in the private sector and academia and everywhere else.
Yeah.
So it's really something the country is grappling with. And we saw strategies being developed for everything 4IR. So we recommended that that we have a consolidated national 4IR strategy that brings in all of these strategies together. But that, of course, needs to be overseen by an APEC sort of coordinator. And we proposed a 4IR commission, but we want the commissioners to serve on a secondment basis, even from private sector, but sort of a pro bono basis, right? Because we don't want to overburden still again yet another commission.
Mm.
And, you know, folks might be thinking, oh my goodness, they want to pay everybody again something and so on. But you know, and then of course there's a AI institute that was proposed, but and a national data center, which is very critical, the data center, but for government. And that speaks to the coordination and fragmentation of data. It's really a big problem. But if you have an AI institute, for instance, you can supply government with services to build your e-government services. You can do R&D, you can do skills training, and you can develop that sort of digital services industry that you not only serve in country, but outside of the country as well, and generate your own revenue.
Okay, Prof, there's a lot to unpack, and I appreciate how difficult it is to talk about such a complex report in such a short period. Perhaps let me just ask, what was the most surprising thing you found out?
I think for me it was like I did not realize the extent to which we're using digital technologies already for innovation. You know, the innovation system was really something that pleasantly surprised me, because we're always looking at ourselves with a very critical eye. And I think the other thing that it didn't surprise me, but I mean, if it comes like that, our infrastructure, right, in general, compares relatively well, you know, to the other countries. Because if you look at something like electricity, we're only 56% covered. But you know what? We're not even the worst in the region. We're short of middle of the road. So while there's improvements supposed to be in there, you know, it's like it's kind of like good to know that we have all of the ingredients already to make it. We just need to enhance some and reduce some.
We're not dead in the water. There's,
no, we're not dead in the water.
Okay, so let's wrap things up. You've homework's in. The teachers are looking at it. You've gone and presented it to the school board. What happens next? What's the next step in the process in terms of the work that you've done?
Well, for me and the task force, it is the end of the road. So, you know, mandate is over, report is in. From here onwards...
Should this report not come out? I mean, it's in, but it has to come out, right?
Well, the one thing is, you know, yesterday in the cabinet, there were a lot of sort of questions from the cabinet ministers and very good questions that came out and observations and so on. And I think there was a lot of good in that. You know, there's always good in exchange. But His Excellency then said, okay, let us do the following. You know, let us go and break down this report. We discuss it, you know, with the various ministers. We interrogate it. And then we see, you know, whether I'm guessing that we will come out with sort of a report that, you know, has a slight revisions, perhaps on its recommendations. That's where I expect the most. And perhaps some of it is added, like Honorable Schlettwein added some components that he felt that we should have looked at, right? Not only in terms of we did implications per sector, even for the general public, right, you know, and so on. But there were specific points that he said, okay, maybe we need to look at, you know, interrogating this and see whether we include it as well.
Okay. And you remain part of that process until the end, or are you now done and you get off to go jet off to a romantic holiday somewhere too?
Well, we obviously have to take responsibility and accountability for our report. So yes, will it be
released publicly?
I believe so, but the public release will obviously be from the Office of the President.
Okay.
So I don't know when that will happen, right. But they will certainly release it to the public.
Well, Prof, on behalf of the country, we thank you for your labor. The fourth IR is an incredibly important issue to grapple with. We need a future for our youth. We need a future for our economy. And we hope that the work that you've done goes a long way in shifting the needle in getting us ready for whatever the future holds. So we thank you, and we'll check in a little bit. I'm sure the report will come out at some point. We'll check in then again and have a chat. But thank you so much for the work that you and the rest of the task force have done.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
That's Professor Nisha Peters, the chair of the task force that was appointed by the President to deal with matters, Fourth Industrial Revolution Task Force, checking how ready the country is to take advantage and also not be left behind by the rapid development of technology.
It's the Business Report with Gary Strubel. The Business Report. Thursdays from 6 to 7 on Novo 1035.
I'm David Bishop with your weekly economics wrap. Striking Transnamib employees have denied accusations that they violated strike rules at Tsumeb, Wolfersbay, Windhoek and Keetmanshoop. While sticking with news of the National Rail Company, it is planning to dispose of its non-core properties around the country as it seeks to raise at least $2.5 billion needed for the implementation of its turnaround plan. Leader of the Popular Democratic Movement, McHenry Vinani, has called on government to be more transparent when it comes to providing information about prospecting license agreements. There was also outcry in South Africa over Namibia and Botswana having blocked imports of certain fresh produce to protect their own internal economies. The country is also set to implement 4 green hydrogen pilot projects worth 892 million Namibia dollars after receiving a 500 Namibia dollar grant from the federal German government and following the handover of the 4th Industrial Revolution Task Force readiness report. We asked the chairperson, Professor Anicia Peters, what benefits 4IR offers for the country.
We think that 4IR is the enabler and sort of to bring everybody on par. In other words, a prospective entrepreneur in Oshikoko can compete the same as a big businessman in Windhoek because the digital trade is borderless. But to be able to do that, we should all be able to use e-commerce, for instance, like PayPal. We should all be able to have good infrastructure, lower data. The price of devices can also come down if we lower, for instance, like import duties on the devices and equipment that's coming in, because otherwise it gets passed on to the consumer.
Across the border, thousands of workers affiliated with the South African Federation of Trade Unions and the Congress of SA Trade Unions downed tools and took to the streets over the rising cost of living. Thus, as the country's annual consumer inflation reached its highest level in 13 years, increasing to 7.8% in July from 7.4% in June. Looking at the rest of Africa, Ethiopia, which is seeking to restructure its external debt of over $28 billion, says it expects a visit of a team of creditors from the International Monetary Fund in September. And shop owners in Ghana are threatening to close their business premises next Monday to protest against the weakening of the country's currency, as traders are finding it difficult to stay in business as the cost of importing and clearing goods continues to rise. India's richest man, Gautam Adani, is set to acquire a major TV news channel, NDTV, one of the few news outlets that are critical of the current administration, in what appears to be a hostile takeover. The governments of the United States and Nigeria have agreed for $23 million looted by former Nigerian dictator Sani Abacha and currently kept in the U.S. to be returned to the country. Turkey's top business association has confirmed receiving a letter from the U.S. Treasury warning of possible sanctions if it continues doing business with Russia, and the U.K.'s Trades Union Congress wants the minimum wage to be increased to £15 an hour from the current £9.50. And finally, economist Jeronim Capaldo says it is not just a global slowdown and the war in Ukraine that is fueling inflation, but that supply disruptions triggered by the COVID-19 pandemic and severe weather that has decimated harvests is also playing a role.
Namibia's business leader on Nova 1035.
Another big show. Thanks for joining us. And hey, thanks for logging in onto our website or catching us on iOno. This podcast also now registered in the Apple Store. You can find us on Apple's podcast service and also been submitted to Spotify. Not quite sure if it's popped up yet, but if it hasn't, it will in the next couple of days. So wherever you catch your favorite podcasts, you can now listen to The Business Report. And thanks for making us Namibia's leading business show and podcast. Thanks, as always, to the team that puts it together, Angie Scholes, David Bishop, Raymond Zierfeld, also thanks to all our guests for making time to come and share their wisdom and insight with us. Mostly thanks to you for making it happen. Thanks for listening. You can get hold of us at tbr@nova.com.na. You can also catch us on Twitter. We're getting smart. Apparently, we're on LinkedIn now as well, and the Business Report continues to grow. Thanks so much for your support. Enjoy the day off tomorrow. We'll catch you next week.
That was the Business Report on Nova 1035. Listen to all the segments and previous episodes with our podcast service on nova.com.na. The Business Report was presented by Gary Strubel and produced by Angie Scholes and David Bishop. Comments and questions can be sent to tbr@nova.com.na.